I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
Everyone, this is Chris Grosso with the Indie Spirituals Podcast on the Be Here Now Network. And my guest today is Mr. Brad Warner. Brad, thank you for being with me.
Hi.
Hi. So let me just quickly read your bio for anyone not familiar with your work. Brad Warner is the author of Don't Be a Jerk and numerous other titles, including Sit Down and Shut Up, Hardcore Zen, and Zen Wrapped in Karma Dipped in Chocolate. A Soto Zen priest, he is a punk bassist, filmmaker, Japanese monster movie marketer, and popular blogger based in Los Angeles. Visit him online at www.hardcorezen.info. Did we get all that correct, Brad?
Yeah. I guess I should make it former Japanese movie marketer, because that's been on there for a while.
Older bio.
I used to work for a company that marketed Japanese monster movies. Yeah.
Yes, you did. And you write about that. That was like in Hardcore Zen and Sit Down and Shut Up that you covered a lot of that.
Yeah. And in Zen Wrapped in Karma Dipped in Chocolate, it shows up too. Yeah.
Very good stuff. Before we get into the new book, we should preface by talking a bit about Dogen, who is a... obviously very influential teacher in your life and is the basis of this new book. So before we jump into that, let's talk about him. Let's talk about his story as well as how you came across him and the influence he's had in your life.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll try to give the shortest Dogen version I can. He was a Japanese Buddhist monk and writer who lived about 800 years ago. He was probably born of the illegitimate son of an aristocrat, a Japanese aristocrat who was murdered when he was very young. He also lost his mother to circumstances we don't really know when he was young. So he lost both of his parents, entered a temple life when he was 12, and was kind of a lifelong monk. He was dissatisfied with the way Buddhism was being presented in Japan in his day, so he went to China, was initially disappointed with Chinese Zen, but found a teacher over there who taught him something he really could get behind, which was this idea of just sitting. So you were doing your meditation not as something to attain a goal like liberation or bliss or enlightenment. You were just doing it to just do it,
right,
which is a kind of a weird thing if you think about it. He came back to Japan and wrote a lot about that. So his main difference between him and a lot of teachers is how much he wrote. He just wrote extensively and left a lot of work behind that we can learn from him. I came across him because when I was a college student at Kent State University in Ohio a long time ago, I just happened to take this class called Zen Buddhism, which at the time I just took it to fill up credit hours, you know, one of those things where you don't have enough hours to be a full-time student, but not really thinking it was going to be much of anything, and was just completely floored by Dogen's worldview and how he approached this idea of discovering what we truly are. And then I moved to Japan and studied it some more and got ordained and wrote some books.
Awesome. And I should say, for anyone in the audience who wants to know more in depth about that, you, like, again, yeah. going back to your first couple of books you write about that, your teacher, his name was Tim, is that correct?
Tim McCarthy was my first teacher, yeah.
Yeah, and then I'm not even going to try to pronounce your teacher in Japan's name. What was his name?
Gudo Nishijima.
There we are. And you write more in depth about that in your earlier yeah. material, which I recommend checking out to the viewers. It's a very fascinating story. And before we move ahead, I like what you're saying about meditating and just sitting there for the sake of sitting there. And I know when you talk about meditation, you take the approach where you close your eyes, or I'm sorry, you don't close them all the way, but about a third of the way open, give or take a little gaze, and you yeah. just stare at a wall, correct?
Yeah.
Rather than yeah. eyes closed, mantras, or breath focused. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's called Shikantaza in Japanese, which just means just sitting. Yeah. And it is a type of meditation that Dogen didn't even like the word meditation or the Japanese equivalent word for meditation, and he thought zazen was a thing unto itself. So the idea is you're not trying to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to get into the pure experience of this moment without any sort of props, and I think it's really interesting and really direct. It's also very difficult because you don't have anything to rely on. It's sort of like being taught to swim by being thrown into the water, and here you go, swim. Yeah. You don't have any sort of props or anything, so you just have to kind of find out for yourself what life is. So you're trying to experience life directly, but you're doing it in a sort of controlled way of sitting quietly in a particular position for a certain amount of time. Doesn't sound very interesting when I put it like that, does it?
and it is and it isn't. That's the interesting yeah. thing. Go ahead, sorry.
It's terribly boring, that's all I was gonna say.
It is, but what I love is that it does come down to direct experience, you know, and it's I'm a big fan of the teachers who work with direct pointing. Let's cut out all of the middle stuff and let's go right to what is here right now. And when you really are able to be there with it, it's pretty incredible. Like, I've had the experience where I'll be sitting there and looking at a wall, for example, and recognizing, holy shit, the body mind, Chris, is not looking at this wall anymore. There is simply seeing happening through this vessel, looking. And it's not even about the experience. It's about cutting through.
Yeah.
I hear that bus.
Yeah, sorry.
No worries at all.
It's garbage day over here.
Nice. But anyways, I'm not saying that experience can't happen with other tips or techniques and whatever, yeah. but I just find that cutting right to the chase is a pretty, literally no bullshit. Let's just get right to it. Let's do it and let's see what happens. So,
well, that's the idea. Yeah, the idea is just to, because what we're trying to experience is life in its rawest state, right. then why put anything between you and life? And of course, Dogen can get really frustrating about this because he'll say even delusion is an experience of pure realization because it's the pure realization of delusion. And you're kind of going, ah, Dogen, stop it. Yeah. So,
well, and so he wrote the Shobo Genzo. Is that right. correct pronunciation? Shobo
yes.
Genzo. And that's what this new book is worked or based on is, you yeah. know, that. But the interesting thing that I did not know was that it was banned in Japan in yeah. 1700. Why was it banned?
You know, it's kind of lost to history, but the speculation is, among other things, it's sort of like the Catholic Church in our history wanting to control how people interpreted the Bible. So the Soto Shu, which was kind of the rough equivalent of that, wanted to kind of dominate the conversation about Dogen, and they didn't want anybody else commenting on it or adding their two cents in. And this lasted for, I don't know, a couple hundred years before it just sort of became impossible.
Right.
and then the Shobo Genzo was rediscovered.
Cool. And so now you put out the new book, Don't Be a Jerk. And I'm sorry for the cliche question, but I've always been a fan of the titles of your books. They're very catchy. They're funny. I dig them. So Don't Be a Jerk. What's the story behind that?
Well, one of the essays that Dogen wrote is called in Japanese, I'll shout over the garbage truck, it's called in Japanese Shōwaku Makusa, which roughly means don't enact wrongdoing or something like that. Any direct translation tends to kind of lose the flavor of it. So I titled that essay, Don't Be a Jerk, and it was just one of the essays I was working on for the book. And I thought it would make a good overall title because it's catchy, and also because he says in that essay that the essence, the true meaning of Buddhist philosophy is don't be a jerk, is don't enact wrong. And he also says any three-year-old child knows this, but adults have a very difficult time actually putting it into practice. So I think that's really important because we're always worried about good and evil and all of that. And we have this kind of idea, which apparently the Japanese people in Dogen's time also had, that there is evil out there and there's good out there. And then we're kind of neutral objects choosing between good or evil. But what Dogen says is evil doesn't occur until somebody does something bad. and that's when evil occurs. And there is no evil outside of what you do.
Yeah. Interesting.
So don't be a jerk.
So don't be a jerk, right. Well, so there's a chapter that you write called You're Already Enlightened, But You're Not. And I want to share a little excerpt from that and then explore that a little bit with you. You write, Dogen's big question when he was a young monk was this: if Buddhism teaches that we're all perfect just as we are, and it does teach that, then why do we have to undergo training? A whole lot of shobogenzo is Dogen's attempt to answer that. So what did Dogen find out, and why do we need to undergo this training?
Well, he uses a lot of metaphors because it turns out that it's really difficult to explain this. And the one he uses early in the work is a guy using a fan. So it's a hot day and the master is sitting fanning himself. And the student says, if air is everywhere, why do you use a fan? And he says, the teacher says, well, you just understand the principle of air being everywhere. You don't understand why we use a fan. So it's a metaphor that's saying, yeah, air is everywhere. The truth is everywhere. But if you don't take some kind of direction towards it, you're going to miss it. I think we need the training because we all have a lot of habits and things that have accumulated over the years. You know, as soon as you're born, we're not sure if you're born with habits. I sort of imagine that you are, but the jury is out scientifically on that. But very quickly, society is putting a lot of stuff into you, you know, from the first minute of trying to tell you how things are. And mostly it's done in a well-meaning fashion by your parents and people like that. But they're often wrong, you know. So what you have to do is kind of find a way through all that and find a way to find the direct experience of life without constantly referencing things you've learned, which is very difficult for us, you know.
It absolutely is. I mean, it's usually about two or three, you know, where we're really beginning to cognize these labels that are being put on us. Me, you know, good, bad, up, down, whatever it is. And then as we're going through elementary school and, you know, being taught what an apple is, but not being taught that apple is just a label, you know, so we begin identifying like the apple with the label and we're not seeing it for what it actually is. So I love what you're saying. It's interesting trying to talk to people about that, you know, who are adults that have spent their whole lives conditioned by this, you know, and then it's like, wait a minute. I'm not who I thought I've been this whole time, let alone like this, you know, this glass right here is not the glass that I thought it was the whole time. Well, yeah, Jason Voorhees is not Jason Voorhees.
Well, so, maybe he is, but I don't know.
Okay, aside from Voorhees. But yeah, I mean, so in your own work then, how do you approach that? I know that's a big question, but...
Well, it's difficult because people, you find that people in general don't even realize they've been conditioned, and of course I don't either. There's certain areas where you can't just the varied nature of communication, like we're doing, like we're talking now, we're using a lot of concepts and things and representations and that in order to help each other understand what each other are thinking. Right. So you can get lost in those representations where you take those representations to be the reality itself. And you'll frame a problem in a certain way. And then after you framed it in a certain way, that framing might not be correct, but you're stuck with it. And so you're always talking about this framing of the problem, which might not be the actual problem. Or because you can only communicate so much of the problem, you tend to kind of get lost in the framework you've created. I don't know. I was just reading, you know, this thing that keeps coming up on the internet of Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter, and everybody does the same explanation. They say, well, it doesn't mean only Black Lives Matter and whatever. So I think that's a nice current eventsy sort of case of where you frame the problem a certain way, and it's a real problem, but the framing itself becomes the problem, because right. You can't, you know, you're starting to argue about this frame that you've created rather than opening up and seeing, oh, there's the actual problem.
Right. You know? Yeah, no, I think that's a great example, and it's very obviously very timely when you see this, because of course all lives matter, but of course Black Lives Matter, and it's such a hot... But I think it was you that posted that CNN video. I saw it first through you, where it's the two protests happening, the Black Lives Matter and then the All Lives Matter. And was that you? Maybe not. I don't know. But
I did post it because I liked it. And I thought, well, you know, you look at it and it's really – you're only seeing about, I don't know, 20 or so people. So it's like, right. Oh, it can't be called a major event. But it was really nice because I don't know which group initiated it. I think it was the Black Lives Matter people who initiated it. But the white guys in there, you know – stars and bars,
the Confederate flag
and all this stuff. Yeah. They were real receptive. All the Black Lives Matter people came over to them and started shaking their hands, and they realized, oh, we got something in common here, you know, and we're all trying to get through this thing. So I thought it was really, you know, heartwarming. In all this other divisive stuff.
You know? I did too. I was actually surprised that you were the guy that posted it, because, you know, you post a lot of skeptic type things, cynical, and that's good. It's healthy. But I was like, wow. And I watched it. I'm like, huh. Yeah, it was good though. Made you feel the feels a little. But so another thing you write about in the book, and this is a tough one for a lot of people, but I think it, man, if we could just get a real grasp on this, maybe this whole All Lives, Black Lives Matter thing could be put to rest. Which obviously this isn't going to happen, but let's talk about the whole no self issue.
Well, yeah, that's a real issue, because that's one of the core teachings of Buddhism, and it goes right back to the beginnings. This idea that there is no self, and that's like the kind of, maybe that's the basic framework we're all working with, is that I have a self, and my self is defined in this way, and our own definitions of ourselves are never clearly defined. I don't think anybody, well, maybe there's a few nutcases who go around trying to, you know, clearly define what the self is, but usually it's just this very loose accumulation that involves a lot of factors.
Right.
And what you realize when you're working with this practice for a while is that all of that falls apart. And you're left with something that you can't possibly define anymore, which is real interesting. but it's very difficult to talk about this idea of no self, because you know, when I first heard it, I thought that's crazy,
right?
You know, because the only thing I really understand for sure is myself. It's like that. You know, this kind of philosophical, I don't know, you distill everything down and go, well, at least I know I'm here. I might not know if this computer is real or if you're real or whatever, but at least I know I'm real. Buddhism kind of rips that out from under you and says, you don't even know if you're real.
Right.
Yes. You know, which is a tough thing to take. But I think if you can find a way to drop that, you won't be constantly referencing that, and you'll have a better ability to deal with real problems, because you're no longer worried about what is my self in this problem.
Right. Yeah, I think that's really well said from my own experience. You know, I said earlier, I think we're sitting and you recognize garbage day.
Yeah, sorry.
No, dude. I think it's kind of actually very fitting. So it's all good. But where, for example, I was sitting on the couch a while back, and there was a vase of flowers in front of me, and mm-hmm. I'm looking at it, and similar to the wall experience, recognizing in this moment, the body mind Chris is not looking at this vase of flowers. There is literally looking happening. That is happening. But I am not, the self is not making that happen. Hearing is happening. I am not making that happen. You know, it's just, it is what it is. It's a life unfolding. It's all part of the totality. And this is where it gets tricky with language, because you don't, or I don't want to cross into that woo-woo-y esoteric, you know. But when you really begin to have this direct experience, and you're like, holy shit, well, who am I? Not the thoughts, obviously, you know, because thoughts are just thoughts. I'm not the emotions, the sensations. It's all just arising in this awareness. And the beautiful thing is, once you see through the illusion of this separate self, the stickiness of all of these things lessens significantly. The stickiness of it being personal, you know. And so again, but a lot of people, it seems... I mean, how do you, again, I know I just asked you, but it's like, how do you really talk to people that aren't, first of all, aren't even interested in it, let alone are interested in it, but have their own preconceived ideas of what it's supposed to be, what the experience is supposed to be like, you know, the bells and whistles, the angels, the bright lights, like, oh my God, when it's the most simplest thing, literally, that there is.
Well, it's real difficult, because you communication in any language requires that I refer to myself in a certain way. Right. And provisionally, there is... Dogen is a kind of a weirdo about the self, because he'll say no self, and then he'll say self. And, because he's saying, if you look at it this way, you can say there is a self. And, you know, the example I always say is, you know, I have my own credit cards and you can't use them, and I have my address, it isn't your address, and all this stuff.
Yeah.
That's all true.
Right.
But ultimately, it doesn't have any ultimate sort of bearing on what life is. And you can, at every moment of every day, you have the experience of non-self. It's just that we tend to frame that experience in terms of self. You'll even say, I had the experience of non-self,
right.
You know, which in a way is true. But about talking to people who aren't, one thing about Zen is that there's no idea of proselytizing. So there's no idea that you're trying to bring this to the masses. I sort of look at my work as trying to make it available, but I'm not really trying to convince anybody, because it's just useless. You know, it's just a waste of time. So you're not, I don't really try to convince people who don't want to know. You kind of have to want to know it in the first place before you're ever going to get it. You know, you have to have that willingness to go, okay, well, maybe I'm wrong about everything. which is tough, because we have a lot invested in being right about things. You have to know, because our minds work like that, of sort of compressing reality into digestible chunks so that you can get through things. You know, you have to know that the red light means stop and the green light means go and all these things. You have so much in there that you just kind of act upon without questioning. And if you started to question every little thing, you'd go crazy. So Zen practice sort of starts with questioning everything, but doesn't end there, because if you ended there, you'd, like I said, you'd go nuts, and you don't want to do that. So I don't know how you talk to people. you just sort of go, ah.
Yeah.
And then they go, oh, what is that about? And you go, I don't know. And then,
That sounds about right. But I do appreciate, because you're right, you're not asking anyone to believe anything. The important thing is find out for yourself what is true, you know, and here are these teachings and pointers, and those are wonderful, but it is up to you and you alone to find out what is true. So that's something that's always deeply resonated with me about your work, and of course people have come before you.
Yeah, that's a hard thing, because people will ask, I'll get asked all the time, what do Buddhists believe? And I have to say, well, you know, it's belief isn't part of it, really. I mean, you could kind of poll people who identify as Buddhists and come up with some core beliefs that they tend to hold. But there isn't this dogmatic thing, at least within the Zen Buddhism, and I think within most Buddhisms, where you say you must believe A, B, and C, and that'll make you a Buddhist. It's actually a whole different approach. It's trying to get outside of your beliefs and see what's true beyond what you believe about things.
Yeah, yeah, I dig that. But Buddhism, like any other, and I know Buddhism isn't a religion, but there's all the different, you know, Theravada and Zen, Mahayana, Madhyamaka, Dzogchen, on and on it goes. So
there's tons of it. Yeah, people people in the West have a limited experience of Buddhism, and I always try to explain it by saying, you know, Buddhism started 500 years before Christianity, and you already know how many versions of Christianity there are. Imagine adding 500 more years of development to that. Yeah. You know, you have even more kinds of Buddhisms than there are types of Christianity.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about the artwork for the cover of this one. I love I mean, that's another thing besides the titles, your book covers are always great.
Here, we can do a visual.
Yeah. And I'm sorry.
Just upside down. Sorry.
my copy is in the bedroom, of course.
Okay.
I was running late, so thank you for having yours.
Yeah, there we go.
So who did the artwork? Was it special for the book, or was that you found that somewhere else and were able to incorporate it?
This was special for the book. Beautiful. You can see the whole thing there. Yeah, if I get it on screen.
It's so good.
This is done by a Canadian guy. He's based in Montreal, and he goes by the name Johnny Crap. I'm not sure what his real birth name is, but that's his punk dharma name, I guess. He's done three of my book covers, and I've never met him. But I went to Montreal in, I think, 2005 and did a talk there, and they had these posters up all over town for this talk. They'd really gone out with the publicity, and they had this great artwork which appeared – I wish I had it to show you. It appeared on the cover of my book, Sit Down and Shut Up, later. Yeah. And I thought they'd gotten it off the internet or something, because it's this fat Buddha riding a Godzilla type of monster. But it turned out it was this artist who'd done the artwork for them. And this one, I think anybody's interpretation of the cover is useful. A lot of people see this as the monster being a jerk, which I can see. But I came up with a concept of it. I didn't draw it, but the idea is this monster is destroying Eheiji, which is Dogen's temple, in the same way that I'm destroying Dogen's beautiful prose in this book, because I kind of, you know, rewrote it, and it's based on the old Japanese. What's the name of the style? But you've seen this style.
Yes,
painting.
Absolutely. That's why I loved it. Yeah. I like your interpretation. That's cool. And that's funny. I'll have to look that guy up, because I live in Ottawa now, like 2 hours away from there. So I don't get out to Montreal often, but it'd be interesting to check his work out. So.
Yeah, apparently he's done a lot of other stuff too. So
I'll look him up.
He should come out with a book of his work, you know.
Really? It was actually, I read Sit Down and Shut Up before I read Hardcore Zen. And I read it because I was this is when I was living in Connecticut. I was at a library and I saw the book cover, and, you know, and I'm sure that's why a lot of people get attracted to your stuff. Same with Noah's work. You know, you see that and it's like you're a punk rocker or a hardcore kid and you see that. It's like, oh, okay. And so, yeah, man, that's cool. I will look at his work.
I thought it was good to approach it this way, because I one of the first things I thought when I had two teachers. There's a garbage again.
Yep.
I thought they'd done all three pickups by now, but anyway, the thing about Buddhist books that I always kind of hated was the cover art. You know, there's some really good books out there whose cover art I just want to cover it with a paper bag or something, because it's always the same thing. It's this little lotus flower rising up out of the dirt, and I think I think a lot of people who might benefit from Buddhism don't benefit from it because they see those covers and go, well, I don't want more of this, you know, garbage. Right, right. And they don't realize that what's inside is kind of really at odds with that, you know, yeah. Especially the Zen form is really kind of in your face and a little bit shocking and sometimes scatological. And it really doesn't fit with the beautiful lotus flower in the pond.
Yeah. I was reading Ikkyo. I don't know if that's the correct
EQ, probably. EQ. Yeah.
And I absolutely loved it. Some of the most just like brutal.
He's kind of a foul mouth.
A bit. Guy. But you know, the cover is like a nice calligraphy. And I'm like, huh, okay, wasn't expecting that. But a friend turned me on to him. And yeah, man, covers are a tricky thing. But yours are always done well. It's cool that New World Library like it works with you on it. And
They always take my suggestions, so that's nice.
Yeah, seem like a good folks. With my second book over, It Sounds True, it was a bit of a give and take. Actually, that took about 3 months because I love them to death. Great experience, nothing against them. The first couple of concepts they came up with, it was really, I was like, come on.
Yeah.
But anyways, so you're talking about covers and turning off, and I love that I saw, this is kind of straying a little bit, but one of my favorite writers, and I'm bummed that I have not read his book yet, but you were posting about Klosterman's new book, Chuck Klosterman.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, I mean, from reading what you wrote about and just reading about, it sounds incredible. I love all of his earlier work. Are there writers besides him, or if you want to talk about him, outside of Buddhism that you are into that you find beneficial or just enjoy in general?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I do like Chuck Klosterman. He's I've met him a couple of times and couldn't say I know him, but he's a close friend of a couple of friends of mine. So that's, you know, I sort of have a little bit of connection there. He used to live in Akron.
Okay.
Yeah, and he was writing for the Akron Beacon Journal local paper.
That's right, yeah.
And I think he's got a real realistic outlook on things. I don't agree with every last thing he says, but I think his attitude is really good. But he's kind of, if I can stray off the question a little bit, he's kind of an example of a person I kind of feel like he's a person who would probably benefit from Buddhism, but would never get into it. And I can, in reading his books, I can see exactly why, because he would kind of, I'm just sort of inventing a Chuck Klosterman in my mind, but I think I'm probably accurate in that a person like that would see it as like, oh, that woo-woo stuff, and you got to meditate and all that, and get immediately like, I want something real here. And I think that's kind of a shame that that's the way it happened. As for other writers, I don't know. I buy tons of books, but mostly about Japanese monsters. And I have three books I'm looking at right now, all on the topic of Gilligan's Island.
okay.
And I've read one of them all the way through, and the other two I'm working on. But, you know, this is what I tend to read about when I don't have to read stuff. In Buddhism, I think there's some people. You mentioned Noah Levine, who I really like, and I'm blanking on his name. Katagiri, Dining Katagiri. He's dead now. He died in, I think, 1990, but he was a Japanese Buddhist priest who wrote actually, he didn't write anything. I'll take that back. But his students collated lectures he'd given into several books that are all worth getting. And of course, they have like lotus flowers on the covers and stuff. Shohaku Okumura, who's still with us, is another Japanese Zen teacher who I think writes some really good stuff. And he does actually sit down and write it. But it's very sort of, it's a bit scholarly. It might turn off some people, but I think he's got a good attitude.
Yeah, well, I know you and I are similar in that. I know you like to read the scholarly material at times. And if I remember correctly, because I remember thinking, yeah, I do too. And a lot of people don't. And speaking of that, you are considering writing a follow-up, correct, on the Shobogenzo, exploring further? Are you still toying with that? Or
yeah, I'm more than toying with it. I started working on it about a month ago to see what I could get. And yeah, it's real interesting, because what I did with this book, for the people who don't know, is Shobogenzo is this old 800-year-old book. There are now three or four complete English translations out there, two of which are easy to get, and the other ones tend to be a little harder to find. But I thought, okay, now that there's all these translations available, the time is right when you can actually do a more interpretive version of it. Because if people want to see a better, you know, technically better translation, they don't have just my little book to rely on. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting to go through this, because I've read Shobo Genzo in translation and a little bit in the original Japanese for years, and what happens if I really dig into it sentence by sentence and line by line and try to come up with a rephrasing? So I'm kind of putting this through the blender of my mind, and this book is what it comes out after that, and that's what we all do. You know, even if you were to read the original Japanese version, even somebody whose native language is Japanese is going to have a hard time understanding it, which in fact is what happened with my own teacher, Gudo Nishijima. When he was a teenager, he came across Shobo Genzo, and he always liked to tell the story that what amazed him most is it was a book in his own language that he could not understand at all. You know, yeah. But it was a highly regarded book, and he could sense that it was saying something. So he kind of devoted his life to trying to understand this crazy ancient book.
Yeah. Well, I really love your take on it. I'm excited to see what else you come up with moving forward, and I hope it does come to pass and it gets released. So excited. Thanks. To stay up on that. Yeah. So there's a couple of blog posts I wanted to check in with you about. I just always love reading your blog. I'm not much of a blog guy, to be honest, but I really dig yours.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, I do. I think dating back, we spoke years ago. It's been a long time, but last time we were talking about when you did about Mo and Curly, and I was just like,
oh no.
Here we go. So
yeah, yeah.
I love that you but that's not the one we're going to talk about today. There's two that I read recently out of many of them, but I'll share an excerpt out of one. It was titled Meditation for Success. Really good one. And a brief part is, you wrote, selling meditation as a key to success destroys meditation. If your meditation is directed at achieving goals, you're only strengthening that part of you which is forever unsatisfied, forever seeking outside approval, forever chasing after money and power. You've discovered an even more effective way to ensure that you'll never be happy, never be balanced, never have any kind of peace. It's so important, and it's such a goddamn big business, man. Like, as we both know, I appreciate, like, when you write, you are very candid about, like, and I don't remember if it was that one or not, but you talk about, am I successful? Well, you know, like, you've written a number of books, you know, you're self-employed, and so in a way, yes, and in society standards, maybe not.
Yeah.
I don't know, so I would love to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, meditation as a business, it's kind of a double-edged sword, to use a cliche.
Sure.
You know, it's in a way, it's good that people are interested in meditation at all in any form. So you know, I always sort of take that as a given. So if I ever criticize it, that's always behind it, which sometimes it gets annoying to state it over and over again.
Yeah.
But some of what happens is it becomes part of the marketplace. So you have to sell it, and people don't. If you told them, like Kodo Sawaki, the famous Japanese Zen reformer of the 20th century, would say Zazen is good for nothing. And if you come out with that, good Lord, this trucks. If you come out saying that, it's really hard to get an audience. And if you're doing it as a business, you've got to have the money coming in to make your business work. So that approach isn't going to work. But that's the only approach there is, ultimately. You have to it's always good for nothing, because what it's good for is for getting you into what's really happening rather than something else. But the business model can you know, it can be good and bad. For example, I've been kind of critical. I'll talk up because this one has really taken a long time. The one I've been kind of critical of, even though I sort of love it and hate it, is mindfulness-based stress reduction.
Okay, yeah.
As a business. And I'll say it again because I have to. I'm glad it's there rather than it not being there.
Sure.
And I think most of the people I've met who are involved within it are very sincere. And I think one thing it does is it's doing one thing good, which is also maybe it's undoing, or maybe not its undoing, but one of its problems is that in order to get hospitals, schools, and places like that involved in meditation, you have to completely secularize it.
Yes.
And that's something I kind of agree with, because I don't, like you just said, I don't think Buddhism is a religion anyway, but everybody else thinks Buddhism is a religion,
right.
and that means you have to eliminate all the Buddhism. So if you eliminate all the Buddhism from it, you're also throwing out 2,500 years worth of research and development,
yeah.
You know, and kind of going, well, now we have to do all that research and development over again. And you'll end up back in the same place, you know. So for example, it gets really sticky to talk about ethics, because ethics gets really hooked in with religion.
Yeah.
But one of the things you have to have ongoing with a meditation practice is a training in ethics. And that's because at some level you'll start to have awakenings and openings if you do the meditation long enough. And if those aren't combined with a deep understanding of ethics, those awakening moments can go really badly.
Yeah.
Because part of it is you're opening up to understanding your oneness with everything. And oneness with everything can make you feel like you're really important now, you know. And that leads to a lot of trouble, because people will kind of lose themselves and start hammering everybody over the head with their oneness with everything, you know. Or it can open the doorway, because understanding your oneness with everyone and everything also makes you understand people and how they work a lot better. And if you are inclined to be a kind of manipulative person to begin with, you've just unlocked the key to the ultimate ability to manipulate anybody.
Yes.
Because you can actually, in some ways, metaphorically at least, get right inside their heads, because you've gotten so far in your head that you understand how your head works, and you understand that everybody's head works exactly the same way as yours. And so you can hone in on it, and this is where a lot of the guru abuses stuff, you know, come from, because they become master manipulators.
Yeah. Horrible. On the lighter side of it, and not lighter side, because it's actually, this has a sad ending, but a friend of mine who's a writer, I was talking to him recently, and we were talking about this, and this whole new age movement and spirituality is a business. And most of me agrees absolutely with you. You know, like, meditation, people are sitting. Cool, man. Like, that's good. He brought up a good point because I was taking that view with him. And he said, I don't know about that. He said, I have a friend who had, you know, severe depression. She had a bunch of other mental things going on. And she walked into, I don't know, pick probably any Hay House author, you know. He just found her way into that kind of market, and was there for about 3 years, kind of spinning her wheels, maybe had some good experiences, maybe not, but ended up just doing that, not seeking any other help, believing, you know, what a lot of the people were telling her, that like, this can do it, you don't need Western medicine. And she ended up killing herself 3 years later, you know. So I know that's an extreme case, and you know, I shouldn't say Hay House. I know it's not right to, you know, call people out, because I'm sure they've done some decent books, but you know, you look at their main roster and...
I don't know them, but yeah, I'll just take your word for
it. Well, then I commend you for not knowing them. So. but they are, when we talk about spirituality as a business, they are like the big business. So anyways, there is that side of it too, you know, where certain teachers, like I saw a t-shirt once that said, meditation over medication. It's yeah. like, no, fuck that. Like, yes, meditate, absolutely. But some people legitimately do need to be on medication, even if it's just short term. And don't guilt them for having to do that. You know, like,
Yeah, I think that's important, and it's a kind of a tricky thing. My own teacher, Nishijima Roshi, the Japanese one, my two teachers had different ideas about medication. So Nishijima was real anti-medication, but he would only talk about that if you asked him. You know, sure. So he wouldn't get on his pulpit and say, don't do medication. But if you actually said, you know, what do you think about this? He'd be like, I don't think this is very good. He's Japanese. He's from a different era. Yeah. He's seeing it a different way. My other teacher, we had a person who was sharing our living space who absolutely needed medication. Yeah. So I know that Tim was very pro medication, because if she got off her meds, it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
So I do think a realistic approach allows for both. You know, the obvious thing that everybody says is that the United States and I'm sure Canada and Mexico and all the places that are influenced by us, Europe, we're really getting over medicated. You know,
couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and people are prescribing things to people who don't really need them. So you have to kind of find where the answer is.
Yeah.
I would say whenever I've had somebody who I've been directly working with who wants to deal with this, I would never advise somebody, I never have, to just drop the medication. I have worked with people closely and said, well, you know, maybe you could see whether a reduced dose works for you at this point in your life, and mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, but these kind of baby steps, I think, is what's needed. Because, you know, there are people who have serious problems. You know, a lot of the thing about the medication, though, the other side of it is you have a society which is already fundamentally wrong in a lot of ways.
Sure.
And sometimes the medication just kind of dulls you to the point where you can deal with how shitty everything is, you know, and that's not a good fit either. So, you know, where does the answer is, it goes on a case by case basis. You can't just make a blanket statement.
Right. And that's right there with you, because yes, there are absolutely some people, I've done a lot of work in the addiction and recovery field, and there are people where their brain chemistry, they're coming off drugs, they need something. I was one of those people. I needed to be on an antidepressant, and I was for about a year, and then I tapered off of it, and that was over 5 years ago, and I haven't taken literally any medication since then. And that works for me, but I would never advocate that, you know, medication is wrong to someone who needs to be on it. I'm reading actually this book right now by a guy named Bob Forrest. Do you know who Bob is? The old singer of Thelonious Monster.
No, I've heard of them, but I don't know.
Yeah, so he's this crazy dude that like came up with the Chili Peppers and Fishbone, and they were, you know, the whole LA scene, Jane's Addiction back in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how, you know, and he was like a full-on heroin addict. And now he's works as a recovery specialist, I guess. And he talks about the difference from the 70s and 80s, where, you know, these were people that were full-on junkies, you know, strung out on heroin, whereas today, and that's what clinicians would have worked with then, whereas today, the majority of clinicians are working with prescribed addictions. You know, it starts out with like Oxy or whatever it might be, and then people start getting multiple prescriptions from multiple sources, and then that's the majority of what people are treating today. It's just... That was an interesting point, you know, because it is how the times have changed. So, yes, I'm not advocating. I mentioned that to say I'm not saying like go take medication either, like case by case.
Yeah, yeah, like it's one of those things you can't put a blanket statement on. I remember the guitarist for Zero Defects like pulling out a joint and said, "Brad uses meditation. I use medication."
Well, actually. There's another blog I want to post, but before we get to that, there was something else that I like that you say in the book, that with a regular meditation practice, we can find a way to the same places that drugs take us. So just like, you know, your guitar said, and so there's, you know, different sides, different camps that are pro psychedelics, anti psychedelics, you know, this and that. And I know you fall on this side of, we don't need anything, you know?
Yeah.
So and the podcast, in all fairness, is on Ram Dass's network, which obviously a lot of psychedelic stuff, but so yes, but so I have a lot of a lot of people that are recovery and addiction experts that come on, and you know, mm-hmm. and well, some of them are for it, some of them are against it. What's important to me is to give a voice to both sides of it, because I think the conversation is the most important part. And I know you fall on the side of don't need it. It's pointless. Didn't you do a talk with Alex Gray not too long ago about this?
Is it Alex Gray that I talked to? I know I talked to the guy that wrote Zig Zag Zen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but yeah, I've talked about it, and it's one of those things. I've done acid, and mm-hmm. I did acid for the, you know, for the spiritual aspects of it. I wasn't interested in partying on a heavy dose of hallucinogenics. I wanted to see God, you know.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed with it. I didn't get to see God. I had my last trip was incredibly bad and everything. You know, it's hard to, if I have to say, if you're going to put me in a position, I don't, you're not personally, but right, if sure. people want to put me in a position, drugs, yes or no, I'll go no.
Right.
On if I want to make my, you know, epitaph, you know, or whatever, you know, where you've only got like so many words to put it on. On the other hand, I'm really actually pretty happy to see, for example, they're doing research on LSD as a preventative for cluster headaches. And as a person who's had severe headaches, I don't know if they're cluster headaches or not, I'm just delighted to see anything that might work for that.
Sure.
And I think researching these drugs is good. And, you know, state of California is about to it's going to be on the ballot in November, whether we want to make full legal marijuana, you know, like Oregon and Washington have. Yeah. And I'll probably vote for full legal marijuana, because I think it's better to have, you know, just get it out of the hands of the criminals and all that.
Sure, yeah.
And besides that, you're going to need something to deal with President Trump.
Oh, Christ.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I know you're in Canada, but you
thank
know.
God. I just moved here a couple of years ago. Timing couldn't have been better.
But I don't know if he'll be president or not. That's a joke. But
yes.
But so I think there's a place for that. And you know, I don't even repudiate somebody who wants to smoke some weed to get high, you know. I understand that, and that's fine. You know, people, you do what you do, and you need a little stress relief sometimes. I don't have a problem with that. It's just when it becomes a substitute, the problem is those substances, not so much marijuana, but ayahuasca and these other things, give you this kind of instant gratification sort of thing, where you can feel like you've really penetrated something amazing, and maybe you have, but it's the method by which you've done it is the problem, because you're given this substance, and all of a sudden you have an awakening or whatever it is, and you go, whoa, that's great. And then, you know, it all comes back crashing in, and you don't have any sense of how you got there or what it means. The metaphor that a lot of the advocates of that will say, they'll say, instead of climbing the mountain, you take a helicopter up to the top of the mountain, which I think is a great metaphor, because you can turn it against them really easily, because it's like the experience of climbing a mountain isn't about being on top of the mountain and getting the beautiful view,
right.
Because you could just rent a video if you wanted that. It's more about the experience, and the experience of climbing the mountain is something itself, which is beautiful and profound and meaningful. And if somebody just plops you on top in a helicopter, you haven't got that experience.
Right.
And I think that's the best case scenario with drugs, you know. And I even think that's a rare instance where you actually have a real spiritual opening mostly what happens is you just have a night of confusion and merriment, you know, maybe merriment.
Yes.
That you later label as being much more profound than it actually was. You know, I think and that kind of stuff, I'm like, oh God, these guys again.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, I've never tried it. Well, I did try it once in a spiritual context, and this was over 10 years ago, and it was the one time I had a very, very bad trip on mushrooms. But, I mean, prior to that, it was all about watching David Lynch movies and listening to Mr. Bungle and, like, you know, just weird shit. Like, and that was fine. Never had a bad experience. But the one time I'm like, all right, like you said, I'm going to see the face of God, and it's going to be awesome. And it was anything but awesome. And it was like, I've told the story before, so I'm not going to tell it again, but I'll just say it was really bad. And I ended up calling my parents to come pick me up. You know, they live 20 minutes away, and like, who calls their parents on mushrooms out of their mind? Like, I was by myself. It was bad, man. It was bad.
Yeah. Mine was that I part of what actually we can tie it to the book, Dogen talks about being time and the illusion of time and whatever. And so on an LSD trip, I really understood the time as an illusion very clearly, and it scared the shit out of me.
Sure.
And I wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And years and years of practice later, I can kind of go, oh, that's what I was seeing. And I can integrate it, and I can be comfortable with it. But at the time, you know, one of the things that happened was I saw that all time was the present moment. But I was on a bad acid trip. I could think to myself, I took the acid 3 hours ago. A standard trip lasts 4 to 6 hours, so at most I've got 3 more hours of this to endure. But I couldn't understand what 3 hours was.
Yes.
Because time is all now.
Yes.
What in God's name is 3 hours? You know, and that just sent me into a total panic.
Wow. You know? Yeah. Oh, I do know. Oh, as I was walking out of my apartment, it was evening or nighttime at this point with my parents. They were taking me back to their house. I looked up the sky, and it was like my first real experience of like no Chris, no anything. You know, it was like timeless in this moment. And all I could muster to say to them, I could barely even speak at this point, was, it's all too real. And that's all I could say, and that was it, man. Yeah. And then I got back to their place, and it was Sunday night, so the Simpsons were on. So thank God that brought me back down. But
that's good, man.
Yeah, if it wasn't for them, I don't know what would have happened. But so this other blog post that I wanted to explore with you, this one was entitled Zen for Aliens. And the excerpt from this one, yeah, we're going there. I like this one. We human beings are capable of communicating with each other on a level of subtlety and detail that we do not find in any other species we know of at present. Our ability to share our experience may make us a unique and important part of how the universe comes to know itself. Right now, we are standing at the very beginning of a process that could have cosmic effects far beyond anything we can even imagine at present. Some of the best science fiction writers have attempted to speculate on the implications of this, but there's no way any human being living today could ever really predict where it might go.
Yeah.
We best not fuck it up.
So. Yeah, I think, being a science fiction nut.
Yeah.
This idea of aliens has always been interesting. I know there's a lot of woo-woo around that, and I kind of go for the standard thing. Is we just don't we rationally speaking, as big as the universe is, and et cetera, there are bound to be something at least a little bit like us.
Yes.
On some other world, but we haven't established any sort of contact with them. You know, I mean, some people speculate that they may be watching us, but I think we can pretty much clearly say that we are not. If they know about us, we certainly don't know about them.
Yes.
Even if they do. So we have this weird position.
Oh, hello.
In all through human history, people have kind of touted that as being a good thing, the greatest achievement. But now we're starting to see. I haven't read the book yet, but I've seen some excerpts of it. There's somebody who's been writing about octopuses. Actually, it turns out I looked this up. Octopuses is correct. Octopi is actually a mistake.
Okay, good to
by
know.
By the way.
Good
to know. So she's been looking at octopuses and seeing how intelligent they are, and it's kind of amazing. It seems her theory, as little as I've read, is the only things that keep octopuses from occupying the top of the food chain is they don't live long enough to get as smart as they could be. I don't know. Because they seem to be almost as intelligent as us, you know, in certain respects. And so so you wonder where this is leading. I wonder. Because we're able to do so much, but we're also doing incredible damage to the rest of the environment, and a lot of our philosophies and such like kind of give us the impression that human beings could somehow separate themselves from the environment and then live on their own and do whatever, or that we should just remake the environment to our liking. But what we're discovering as we do that more and more is that we're actually really, really connected with all these things. You know, without the trees in the Brazilian rainforests, we die, you know, so we can't just pave over the Brazilian rainforest and make a shopping mall because that would kill us, you know.
Right.
So we're finding out how integrated we are in all of this. But we also have this special position. You know, a lot of people who are, I think, very well-meaning will kind of be almost anti-human in the sense of like, well, if all the humans died, everything would be much better. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think we're part of the environment, and we have a special place. Not special in the sense that it's better,
right.
But it's, I think, if the African gray spotted moth, you know, whatever it is that people are protecting this week, and yeah. rightly so, is worth preserving, we are also worth preserving.
Right.
Because we're adding something else unique to the blend, and we have to kind of find the way to integrate all of that, you know, and then maybe the aliens will talk to us. I don't know.
Time will tell. We will see. Should be interesting. So, well, Brett, I thank you for your time. I mean, I feel like we could have talked for another hour easily, but it's a podcast. I have to watch that hour mark. But so again, the website where people can find you is hardcorezen.info. That has your social media stuff linked up, your events, all of that good stuff, correct?
Yeah. That's hardcorezen.info is the best way. That's and that, everything is connected through there.
Cool. Well, any parting words before we call it a day here? Anything I didn't cover that you want to share?
No, thanks. Okay. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Sorry we missed our initial the folks in TV land don't know that we missed our connection a couple of days ago, but sorry about that.
No apologies necessary. It's life. Like I said, it's happened to me before, so I understand. But it was great connecting with you. It really is a wonderful book. I can't recommend it enough, as well as your prior works. And I'm excited to see what comes of this new one you're working on, man. So thank you sincerely for the time and also for putting this stuff out there in the world that's needed and appreciated.
I appreciate it.
All right, man.
Peace.
Be well.